You're now tuned in to Cognitive Flow, brought to you by OptimalAnesthesia.com, where clinical insight meets focus clarity. Today, we are doing a deep dive into something absolutely fundamental for us in the operating room, the cardiac conduction system. But we're not just looking at diagrams. We want to connect the dots, like right down to the molecular level, the ion channels, and see how that plays out in real OR situations, you know, the high-stakes stuff.
Exactly. That's the mission today. Okay. We want you to think about the heart's electrical system less like static anatomy and more like a dynamic power grid. And as the clinician, you really need to understand which parts of that grid your anesthetic drugs are messing with, sometimes intentionally, sometimes not so much.
Okay, so let's map out that power grid right away. We can use that simple analogy, three main parts, right?
Right.
We've got the sinoatrial node, the SA node, that's the power plant kicking things off.
Mm-hmm.
Then the atrioventricular node, the AV node, that's like the traffic light, controlling the flow, yeah. Adding that crucial delay.
Yeah, the gatekeeper.
And finally, the bundle of His and the Purkinje fibers. Those are the high-speed cables, getting the signal out fast and wide.
And the key thing is, each of those parts, the plant, the light, the cables, they run on different molecular engines. Which means, crucially, they have different vulnerabilities to the drugs we use.
Okay, let's dig into that, starting at the source, the power plant itself. The SA node, it's the heart's natural pacemaker sitting up there in the right atrium. I always found that idea of the self-charging battery really neat. It doesn't need anything else to tell it to start, does it?
Nope, exactly. It just goes. And the mechanism behind that self-starting ability, that's what's really fascinating. It's all about the funny current, usually called IFA.
A funny current, okay.
Yeah, it's carried by sodium and potassium ions moving through these special channels called HCN channels. And here's the weird part, the funny part. These channels actually open up when the cell gets more negative inside, when it hyperpolarizes after the last beat.
Huh. So instead of waiting for a signal, the resting state itself triggers the next buildup.
Precisely. As soon as the cell recovers from a beat and gets really negative, these HCN channels open, letting positive ions slowly leak in. It's this slow, steady trickle of positive charge building up, until it hits the firing threshold.
And then the main event happens.
Yeah, and the main event. Once threshold is reached, it triggers a big calcium spike, mainly through Cav1.2 channels, and that causes the actual heartbeat signal to fire off. But it's that slow HCN leak, that funny current, that really sets the pace. It dictates the heart rate.
Okay, so clinically then, what happens if we interfere with that, if we suppress that funny current?
Well, if you slow down or block IFS, you directly slow down the heart rate. You get sinus bradycardia. Or if the block is severe enough, the SA node might just quit and you'll see junctional rhythms take over.
And which drugs are we talking about here?
The classic example is sevoflurane. It's known to inhibit those HCN channels. This explains why bradycardia is so common during sevoflurane induction, especially, and this is key, in pediatric patients.
Right. Kids and sevo bradycardia, it's a known thing. Why are they more susceptible? Is it just higher vagal tone?
That's definitely part of it. Yeah, higher resting vagal tone. But also, their ion channels, including HCN, are generally a bit less mature, so they're just more sensitive to the effects of volatile anesthetics like Stevo.
So knowing that mechanism Stevo hits HCN means you need to be ready.
Absolutely.
Right.
You anticipate that potential slowing.
Yeah.
You have atropine, glycopyrrolate, maybe even ephedrine drawn up and ready to go.
And that calcium dependence we mentioned for the final push, that sometimes comes into play too, doesn't it? I recall reading about a case, a 65-year-old, known sick sinus syndrome, having a hip replacement.
Yeah.
Gets propofol for induction, develops really severe bradycardia.
Oh, okay. That's a great illustration. So even though the primary pacemaker, HCN current, is failing, knowing that the final trigger involves that Cav1.2 calcium channel, it explains why giving IV calcium gluconate might actually give you a temporary boost in heart rate. It's not fixing the underlying problem, but it can buy you critical time while you get pacing sorted out.
Right. And on the ECG, you're looking for the signs, aren't you? Long gaps between P waves, maybe pauses, or even just no P waves if the SA node is really struggling, like the power plant is sputtering.
Exactly. Power plant failure.
Okay. So if the signal does get out of the SA node, even if it's slow, it hits the AV node next. The traffic light, its job is to hold things up deliberately.
Yeah, that delay is absolutely vital. It gives the ventricles enough time to fill properly before they contract. Imagine if the atria and ventricles fire together, no effective pumping.
So how does it create that delay, physiologically?
It's basically designed for inefficiency, in a good way.
Yeah.
The AV node cells have fewer connections between them specifically. Fewer of these proteins called connexins, particularly CY40. Less connections means slower electrical spread.
Fewer pathways.
And it also relies on different ion channels for the main impulse, unlike the fast ventricular tissue.
It uses the slower ones again, like the SA node's final trigger.
Exactly. It heavily depends on those L-type calcium channels, Cav1.2, to carry the action potential along, not the super-fast sodium channel. So it's inherently built to be slow and, importantly, more sensitive to certain drugs.
Right. So if Cav1.2 is the key player here, then drugs that suppress that channel are the main worry for the AV node. What are we looking at?
Well, blocking Cav1.2 is the main pathway to causing AV block. You see this with propofol, which has some calcium channel blocking effects. Mm. And obviously, giving actual calcium channel blocker medications will do it too.
And the clinical impact isn't just a slightly longer PR interval on the ECG, is it?
No, not at all. If you slow down AV conduction too much, especially in someone who's already a bit dry, maybe hypovolemic, that excessive slowing can cause profound hypotension. If their cardiac output is heavily reliant on heart rate and you take that away, things can go downhill very fast.
Which is why having atropine or glycopyrrolate ready, especially for induction, is just standard practice.
Absolutely non-negotiable.
Particularly thinking about surgeries where vagal reflexes get triggered easily, like thyroid surgery.
Yeah. Thyroidectomy is a classic example. That traction on the neck structures, manipulation near the carotid, it can cause intense vagal stimulation. And you can see a transient but potentially high-grade AV block appear just like that.
And you need to react instantly.
Instantly. A quick push of atropine blocks that vagal input, restores AV conduction. It can be a real save. On the monitor, you're watching that PR interval like a hawk. Is it getting longer? Are you starting to see dropped QRS complexes, the Mobitz RT2 patterns? Or worst case, are the P waves and QRS complexes totally doing their own thing? Complete block.
Okay. Signal gets through the AV node. Now it needs to fly. It needs to hit all parts of the ventricles almost simultaneously for a good strong contraction. Now we're into the high-speed cables, the bundle of His and the Purkinje fibers.
Right. These are built for pure speed. They are packed with connections. This time it's mainly CDase43 connections, allowing rapid cell-to-cell signal transfer. And crucially, they rely on the very fast Nav1.5 sodium channels for that rapid depolarization phase. That's what makes the signal travel so quickly down through the ventricles.
So fast sodium channels are key here.
Absolutely key. We should also mention, though, they can act as a backup pacemaker if both the SA and AV nodes fail. But they're much slower, maybe 20, 40 beats per minute, last resort only.
Okay, Nav1.5, that rings a bell. This is where things get really dangerous with certain drugs, isn't it? This is the main target for, last thing to Miri, local anesthetic toxicity.
Precisely. Blocking Nav1.5 is why LAST is so catastrophic, especially the cardiac effects. When you get toxic systemic levels of local anesthetics, particularly the potent ones like bupivacaine, they have a high affinity for these Nav1.5 channels in the Purkinje system. They bind strongly and block them.
And blocking the fast sodium channels in the high-speed wiring, what does that do?
It grinds conduction to a halt. You lose that rapid coordinated spread of the signal. This leads directly to the most feared cardiac outcomes of Lanstery. Dramatically wide QRS complexes on the ECG, ventricular arrhythmias like VTach or VFib, and ultimately a systole. You've essentially severed the main power lines to the ventricles.
And understanding that specific mechanism, the Nav1.5 block, is crucial because it dictates the treatment, right?
Absolutely critical. That widening QRS complex is your direct visual evidence that the fast sodium channels are being poisoned. Seeing that, especially in the context of potential local anesthetic overdose, like after a regional block, is the trigger. It screams lipid emulsion therapy.
No lipid rescue.
Yes, intralipid. It's a specific antidote thought to soak up the lipid-soluble local anesthetic molecules. You also need to be ready for advanced cardiac life support, potentially pacing. But lipid is the specific first step for the toxicity itself.
Like that scenario you hear about, patient gets a block, maybe an epidural top-up with bupivacaine, then suddenly the QRS starts widening, blood pressure tanks.
That's the nightmare scenario. That wide QRS isn't just some benign conduction change. It's a sign of imminent cardiovascular collapse. Lipid infusion immediately.
It's the signature of the high-speed wiring failing.
Exactly.
Okay, wow. Lots of moving parts. Let's try to synthesize this, maybe like a quick clinical summary, tying the drugs, the channels, and the immediate fixes together.
Yeah, like mental flashcards. Good idea. Four key ones.
Okay. Card one, SA node, drug, sevoflurane, channel, HCN, funny current, problem.
Pediatric bradycardia, mostly. Solution, anticholinergic atropine, glycopyrrolate, to counteract the vagal tone that SIVO unmasks by blocking HCN.
Okay, card two. AV node, drug, propofol, channels, mixed, but includes Na and Kalu, like CAV 1.2, problem.
AV delay, potential block and associated hypotension. Solution, slow, careful titration of propofol and ensure good volume status before you induce. Prevention is key.
Got it. Card three, general vagal tone. Drug, strong opioids like fentanyl, mechanism. Not a direct channel block, but increases vagal output via potassium channel effects. Colliflux, problem.
Bradycardia again. Solution. Same as with SIVO-induced bradycardia, really. Be ready with anticholinergics. It's an autonomic effect, but the result is similar.
Right. And card four, the Purkinje system. Drug. Bupivacaine at toxic levels. Channel. NAV 1.5, fast sodium. Problem.
Wide QRS, ventricular arrhythmias, potential is systole, the big one. Solution. Immediate lipid-emulsion therapy, intralipid, and prepare for pacing ACLS. No messing around.
That's a great summary. But of course, it's not just about the drugs we give, is it? The patient's baseline condition, the surgical environment, that power grid can be unstable before we even start.
Oh, absolutely. Drug effects are only half the story. You absolutely have to consider electrolytes. They are fundamental. Think about potassium. Hypokalemia, low potassium makes the heart muscle cells more irritable, delays repolarization, big risk for arrhythmias like torsades.
And high potassium.
Hyperkalemia. But that's dangerous too, but in a different way. Very high potassium levels actually inactivate the fast sodium channels, the NAV 1.5 channels. It can look a bit like ALIs. You get wide QRS complexes, risk of blog, even a systole.
So electrolytes need to be optimized pre-op.
Always. And then think about the surgery itself. Simple things like pain, or the surgeon stimulating the airway, or the insufflation pressure during a LAP case, that nodal peritoneum. These things cause huge swings in autonomic tone, messing with heart rate and conduction.
Right. Vagal responses, sympathetic surges.
And don't forget ischemia reperfusion. If you have a case involving aortic cross clamping or cardiac surgery, when blood flow returns to that tissue, you can get a sudden flood of calcium into the cells. Calcium overload, that's a major trigger for arrhythmias, completely separate from your anesthetic drugs.
Okay, so given all these factors, drugs, electrolytes, surgical stimuli, what are the key things you're watching for on the monitors beyond just the basic heart rate and rhythm?
You need to develop an eye for the subtle stuff on the ECG. Is the PR interval creeping up? Is the QRS getting just a little bit wider? These can be early warnings. On the arterial line, don't just look at the pressure number. Look at the waveform. If it suddenly dampens or you lose pulsatility, that could mean a sudden drop in cardiac output from a conduction block or severe bradycardia.
Even before the pressure number plummets.
Sometimes, yeah. And interestingly, even watch the BIS monitor if you're using it. A sudden, sharp drop in the BIS number that isn't explained by drug administration. It could indicate reduced blood flow to the brain because of an undetected arrhythmia or severe conduction issue.
Wow. Okay, so vigilance is key. Who should we be most vigilant with? Which patient groups are at highest risk for these conduction problems under anesthesia?
Well, we mentioned pediatrics already. Those immature ion channels, higher vagal tone, they're just more sensitive, especially to volatile anesthetics causing bradycardia.
Makes sense.
Then, definitely the elderly. They often come in with pre-existing conduction system disease. Maybe they already have a bundle branch block or subclinical sick sinus syndrome. Plus, they're often on multiple medications, polypharmacy, that can interact with anesthetics in unpredictable ways.
Right. And what about patients already on heart rhythm medications?
Huge group to be cautious with. Patients taking antiarrhythmics like digoxin or amiodarone or beta blockers or calcium channel blockers. Our anesthetic drugs can have additive or synergistic effects with their home meds. You can easily push someone with controlled AV delay into a complete block, for example.
So for these high-risk folks, what's the approach? How do we manage them safely?
It's really a three-phase approach. Pre-op, intra-op, and thinking about guidelines. Pre-op. Get a recent ECG. Absolutely correct any electrolyte abnormalities, especially potassium and magnesium. Look for any history or signs of inherited channelopathies, like long QT syndrome.
Okay.
Intra-op. Continuous ECG is standard, obviously. But have your rescue drugs, atropine, glycopyrrolate, ephedrine, immediately available. Not just in the drawer, but drawn up if possible for high-risk cases. And seriously, consider putting external pacing pads on the patient before induction if they have significant pre-existing conduction disease, like high-grade AV block history or severe bradycardia. Saves critical time if things go wrong.
Proactive pacing pads, yeah. Smart.
And finally, guideline integration. Remember the major cardiology and anesthesia societies, like ESC, ACA, ASA, have specific recommendations. They generally mandate having temporary pacing capability readily available for patients with high-grade AV block going into surgery. And for patients with existing pacemakers, or ICDs, CIDs, you need that pre-op and post-op device check, the interrogation, to make sure it's programmed correctly for the OR environment and functioning afterwards.
Okay. So wrapping this all together, the big takeaway seems to be that we as anesthesia providers really need to be experts in both the drugs we give and the electrical system they act upon. It's pharmacology plus electrophysiology.
Exactly.
You have to anticipate the problems by knowing the channel targets HCN, Cav1.2, Nav1.5, and linking that knowledge to the ECG, the patient's condition, the surgery, and then intervening precisely based on that understanding. That seems to be the core of keeping the heart electrically stable.
Couldn't have said it better. It's about connecting the molecular science directly to the bedside, or rather the OR table. And maybe a final thought for you to chew on. Think about the future. We're seeing more and more genetic testing becoming available. Imagine a scenario where preoperative screening routinely identifies patients with specific genetic variants that make them, say, more susceptible to bupivacaine cardiotoxicity because of a slightly altered Nav 1.5 channel. How might that change how you choose your local anesthetic or how closely you monitor them or even your threshold for using lipid emulsion? It could really shift preoperative risk assessment for these anesthetic-induced conduction issues. Something to think about.
Definitely a fascinating point. Personalized anesthetic risk based on channel genetics, definitely food for thought. Well, thanks for joining us on today's episode of Optimal Anesthesia. For in-depth notes, visuals, and bonus content, head over to optimalanesthesia.com. And if you're looking for exclusive podcasts, early releases, and deeper clinical insights, you'll find all that at patreon.com/eoptimalanesthesia by Rennie. Support the learning, support the craft. See you in the next one.